I'm going to open the Senate Committee on Health Care and Veterans Affairs. We have a really huge agenda today. Everyone wanted to have their bill heard today, so that's why it is the way it is. We were trying to accommodate those people who were here, who wanted to be here and could only be here on this day. So we are going to start out as the agenda is posted at this point in time, correct?
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
All right, and we have a series of Oregon Health Fund Board recommendation bills that they have a companion bill on the House side, but with conversations with Mitch Greenlick and Tina Kotek and Doc Bates, who's the chair of the Ways and Means, we decided that it would be more important to have those sister bills over on this side. And so this is one of those first sister bills that we're going to be hearing, and it's going to be opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 451. And if I could have the witness
sure.
registration, and if you could...
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 451 requires the Department of Human Resources to establish and operate a statewide registry for collection and dissemination of physician orders for life-sustaining treatment, and establishes an Oregon Registry Advisory Committee.
And I forgot to say that I am a subcommittee of one right now until we get a quorum. All right. With that, shall we start out with, does Dr. Toll, Susan Toll, want to start out? All right.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee.
Sorry about that.
No problem. You're at least number two.
I'm Dr. Susan Toll. I'm a general internal medicine physician and direct the Center for Ethics in Healthcare at the Oregon Health and Science University. And what we're going to do is show a movie to set the stage. It's a 3.5-minute movie about the Pulse Registry that we're proposing.
Mary and her friend Maxine like to spend time outdoors, growing flowers and vegetables in their retirement community garden. It's sunny and warm today, and the women are harvesting tomatoes. Mary, who is 84 and has significant medical problems, begins to feel the heat as she climbs the stairs toward her apartment. Suddenly, she collapses, and Maxine finds her on the grass. She calls 911. Within minutes, an ambulance and rescue vehicle arrive, and paramedics tend to Mary, who is barely conscious. While they're assessing her condition, they ask if she has a physician orders for life-sustaining treatment form, known as PULSED.
Does she have a PULSED form?
She has a PULSED form. It's up in her apartment.
Since Mary's apartment is some distance away, one of the paramedics phones into the electronic PULSED registry for her medical information.
Yeah, we have a Mary Hughes. She lives on Holy Names Drive. Date of birth is 5/11/24. And she has a PULSED form on file. Could you get us the information for us, please?
Mary's PULSED orders are do not resuscitate and limited additional interventions. Based on those orders, EMTs assess her injuries and prepare her for transport to a hospital where a faxed copy of her PULSED form will be available. This scenario is a dramatization meant to illustrate how an electronic PULSED registry now being established in Oregon would allow patients like Mary to receive the interventions they want and say no to those they don't, even if they cannot speak and their written orders are not close at hand. Paramedics tell us that situations like this one are not uncommon.
PULSED is a written order. That's the standard that we want to find at the scene. We cannot withhold any treatment that we're capable of giving without a legal document that authorizes us to withhold that. As we're working on the person, I think if this was me, I wouldn't want this to be happening right now if it was my mother or father, but without legal guidance, we have to do everything within our ability regardless.
Emergency physician Terry Schmidt is helping to develop the registry. She explains to paramedics how information on PULSED forms in the registry will be shared with authorized emergency personnel while still protecting patient confidentiality.
I think our registry is a terrific idea. It's late in coming, if you ask me. I could have used this years ago. The sooner we get it in use, the better off we'll be, and better off the patients who have PULSED will be.
I want to thank you for coming to my rescue.
Thankfully, Mary suffered nothing more serious than heat exhaustion, and after evaluation and IV fluids, is back in her apartment.
It's really great that my wishes were carried out, and that the registry for the POLIS form was available.
Glad to hear that it works.
Yeah.
The Center for Ethics in Healthcare has served as the administrative home for the PULSE program since the very beginning. The program started in 1990. I was checking. See if everybody's awake. In 1990, when ethics leaders came together all over Oregon, and we realized that in every one of our hospitals, people with advanced dementia in nursing homes were getting pneumonia, being transferred to our hospitals, and ending up on ventilators in our intensive care units, with families saying, "Mom wouldn't want this," and that there was no good ability to communicate wishes from one care setting, the nursing home, to the ambulance, to the hospital. A group was convened that ultimately became the Oregon PULSE Task Force and designed what now is this bright pink order form called Physician Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment. Initially, this was pilot tested in 1995 in nursing homes in the Portland area and around parts of the state. It was so effective that it is now used by every Medicare-certified hospice program in Oregon and by 95% of Oregon nursing homes. It's effective enough that it's being copied by other states, and half of states across the country have now copied a PULSE-like program in their state. It was developed here in Oregon. What the PULSE form does is that it recognizes that without written medical orders, emergency medical personnel must provide all treatments, whether or not they're wanted. They need written orders to the contrary. The form is for people with advanced illness, advanced heart disease, advanced lung disease, metastatic cancer, or advanced frailty. Mary Hughes in the movie is about as healthy a person as we would encourage to have a PULSE form. Healthier people should have an advanced directive. If on the way home we hit the bridge abutment and I have a bad head injury, I want LifeLight. I want everything done. But later my advanced directive says who should make decisions for me if I can't make decisions for myself, and give some guidance. But if I have advanced illness, then I might mean tonight, in the here and now, if I'm found down. And then a PULSE form could be extremely useful. It's the only way emergency medical personnel can limit life-sustaining treatments. The PULSE program is entirely voluntary. No one has to have a PULSE form, and if you have one, you can have a mix of treatments to have or to limit. As we saw in the movie, this is someone, Mary Hughes, who wanted to go to the hospital and have IV fluids, but she did not want to go to intensive care. So tracking that is the hardest thing for medicine. When it's all or nothing and you don't go, it's one thing. When you go to the hospital and you want to set certain limits, that's the advanced course. That's where PULSE comes in. This bright pink form is very effective when it's found. There are times in a time of crisis in a private home when someone didn't put it on the refrigerator and emergency medical personnel can't find it. An example is in your packet. It's the story of Elizabeth Hirsch. Her family was kind enough to allow us to share information about the tragic circumstance that her family faced. And that circumstance was at 88 years old. She had a PULSE form. She collapsed at home. A friend was visiting, called 911, didn't know about the PULSE form. And she stopped breathing, en route to the hospital, was put on a breathing machine, put in intensive care. And the next day, her family brought in the evidence of her pulsed form and made the difficult decision to stop life support, absolutely certain she never wanted it. But she died in intensive care. She died peacefully and never woke up. But for some families, the decision-making to stop is very onerous. It is one thing to be sure it was never wanted to be started, but feeling that extra emotional burden of stopping can be very hard on families. And some take much more time than Elizabeth Hirsch's family took. Some take days and have loved ones fly in from other parts of the country. Some actually, while they would never have wanted it started, can't actually ever make the decision to stop. Senator Dr. Alan Bates wisely recognized the problem that pulsed forms can't be found. And last session, in the health care reform bill, Senate Bill 329, placed a line instructing the Health Fund Board to create a pulsed registry. The Health Fund Board has been meeting with the Oregon Pulse Task Force, and together we have designed what a registry would look like and what it would take to implement it, and have begun building it with private funding. The overall goal is that people like Elizabeth Hirsch will have a backup system. The original pulse form will be the gold standard. If it's there, it works just as it does now. But if it's not there and it can't be found, this is a backup system to assure that wishes are followed. We're building on an existing system, which is inside the OHSU emergency communication system, a system that already exists around the clock. Dr. Terry Schmidt, who will follow me in testimony, will tell you more about how this registry will function. We are proposing a public-private partnership. The Center for Ethics in Healthcare will continue to fund every aspect of the Pulse program through private philanthropy. We will continue all of the roles we serve now, and the registry will be through the Department of Human Services and operate under the supervision of DHS. Just the registry function, just forms coming in, forms getting to where they need to be needed. The Center for Ethics in Healthcare will continue all of the tremendous educational activities we do now about the Pulse program through private philanthropy. You have a couple of brochures at the back of your packet, and I call them to your attention because they are examples of the kinds of educational programs that we have for a wide array of groups. We provide these to skilled nursing facilities, physician offices, and others. The one in English was deliberately written to help people with lower levels of health literacy. We have very much incorporated some graphics and made every effort to bring our language level down to help people who are not as skilled as members of this committee. With physicians and nurses and others very able to understand what we're talking about today, but some members of the community really struggle with what does some of our technology mean. Likewise, we have a brochure in Spanish, and these are among a number of educational materials that we provide. They're all available at the pulse.org website that can explain exactly what kind of resources we have, but we are very committed to the education of all primary care providers, emergency medical personnel, nursing home personnel, hospice leaders and personnel, and through them, outreach to the public. And all of this we will continue to support through private philanthropy. We are estimating that the Ethics Center's contribution will be $1 million over the coming biennium. And this is to continue the distribution of the Pulse program as well. We do all the mailings of the Pulse forms to nursing homes, and the tremendous amount of education, which will be obviously far larger than the state's contribution. We have already raised $350,000 in private philanthropy to bring us from January of last year through June 30th of 2009 to build the database for the registry, test it, and begin rollout in Clackamas County to pilot test this and develop things like this movie, and we have an expanded version of educational materials that we are showing. For example, I had the pleasure of showing at Kaiser yesterday, because Kaiser obviously is a major health system in Clackamas County. So we are beginning to accept forms now into this new registry, and we will further test it, but are asking for support for statewide implementation. We also need your support for another reason. This legislation allows us to respond to the requirements of HIPAA privacy. Without legislation, a second release form has to be signed every time a pulsed form comes into the registry. And the Kaiser physicians yesterday made it very clear what an extra burden the additional release form for every pulsed is. This will make us the registry for the state, and therefore transfers will not require additional separate authorization to submit for the registry. We are proposing that the Ethics Center continue all of the things it does now through private gift and grant funding. We have been doing this for over a decade. This is a sustainable program for support statewide. And we are consulting with all of the other states that are implementing programs, again, through private philanthropy. We do not accept gifts from the biomedical industry, and never have, to the Center for Ethics in Healthcare. And our goal, among many of the goals of the Ethics Center, is to respect the wishes of those with advanced illness to have or to limit treatment. After my colleagues have a chance to speak, I welcome the opportunity to answer any questions you may have and to explain further why a statewide registry would provide an effective system to honor the freedom of those Oregonians who wish to set limits on life-sustaining treatment. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Toll, very much. Terry Schmidt.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am Dr. Terry Schmidt. I'm a professor of emergency medicine at OHSU and the EMS medical director for Clackamas County. I thank you for this opportunity to get to talk to you today about what I think is a really important expansion of the PULSED program. As Dr. Toll previously mentioned, PULSED is designed to honor the treatment preferences of patients near the end of their lives, be that for treatment, against treatment, some moderation in between. But frequently, it's difficult for those orders to be honored because they're difficult to find. Dr. Toll mentioned the plan to put them on people's refrigerators. We've heard over and over again that people do not want a bright pink form on their refrigerator, and that the people of Oregon really would support having a alternative electronic means. I'm not going to talk a lot more about the details of why this is a good idea, but rather give you a little overview of the actual logistics and how we envision the program to work. As Dr. Toll noted in her testimony, in the case of Elizabeth Hurst, this is common. And I've had several opportunities now to talk to EMS providers, both here in the Salem area and the Portland metropolitan area. And I frequently ask them the simple question, have you ever had an example where you went to the scene of an emergency and you thought the person had a pulsed form, but you couldn't initially find it? And looking around the room, every hand goes up. This is a common problem. So how is the registry going to work? I think it's important to note that what we plan to do is build on some existing resources in order to do this in the most cost-effective and efficient manner that we possibly can. The OHSU Emergency Communication Center has been in existence for many, many years and currently is staffed 24/7 by experienced communication specialists who are used to talking to EMS providers and hospitals because they currently provide online medical control or the access to physicians for EMS questions. They talk to EMS providers about the trauma system. They're the disaster communication centers. So they're very experienced, and the plan is to have this registry existing at that communication center and for EMTs to be able to call in and get the information in real time from them. And we think we can do this with a relatively small increase in expenses by adding some small staffing to make it a statewide rather than a regional resource, but again, using a very experienced communication center. There are what we think are three important features of any registry that would be developed that are important to be protections in the registry. First of all, the information has to be accurate and entered into a timely fashion. Secondly, the important health information that's in there must be secure and protected. And finally, and in some ways critically, every time that a call is brought in, we need to be absolutely sure that the right form is found for the right patient. Nobody ever wants a situation where the wrong information is conveyed to the EMS providers. So in order for the information to be accurate and in a timely fashion, the forms will be completed in a provider's office, then faxed into the registry office, entered into a database, and always rechecked by a second person to confirm that the data is accurate before it's released into the registry for the communication center, with the goal being that this will happen within 24 hours. This is important because for many patients, their forms are completed very close to near their end of their life, and things happen very quickly, so getting them into the registry quickly is an important goal. Secondly, the registry is containing personal health information and other medical information, and so it needs to be well protected. Our proposal is that this, if it is awarded as we plan to OHSU, would be that it would exist behind the OHSU firewall and have the same protections to it as any other medical record that exists in our institution. It's a separate registry. It is not in any way integrated with the health records of OHSU, but in the same data protection as all health information is for us. And that the information would only be provided to EMTs calling in and to hospitals who are actually receiving these patients. And finally, it's critically important that we get the correct information about the correct patient conveyed out to EMS. So we are currently modeling and testing the system. We have a database that has already been built with the private philanthropy that's come into the Ethics Center. We have loaded a large number of mock forms into the registry and right now are in the process of doing some test call-ins with similar names, similar birth dates to make sure that when people receive the calls, they find the right forms, and are planning in the next month to several months to begin to load up real forms into it and begin a pilot test in Clackamas County over the next few months so that by the time this bill, if passed, occurs, we will have a existing prepared system that should be ready to start up fairly quickly. Just in summary, this really is a partnership between the state and private efforts and is truly designed to honor the wishes of patients near the end of their lives. And like Dr. Toll, when we're finished, I'm happy to answer questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Schmidt. Dr. Smith.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, I'm Janine Smith, the administrator for the Office of Health Policy and Research, which helped to staff the Oregon Health Fund Board effort. And I just wanted to touch on a few details around the bill itself. And as Dr. Toll mentioned, this was directed by Senate Bill 329 for the Oregon Health Fund Board to address this. And I will call your attention to our fancy, glossy overview of the Health Fund Board's recommendations, thanks to the generous donation of Northwest Health Foundation. It tries to summarize those recommendations.
I'm so glad you qualify that in these budget times.
I wouldn't want to get in trouble. We really look at this initiative as the next best steps towards a system transformation of our healthcare delivery system. And the executive directors, both past and present of the Health Fund Board, myself, and the Department of Human Services Public Health Division have worked closely with Dr. Toll and Dr. Schmidt and the Pulse Task Force over the last several months to bring you this piece of legislation. It really envisioned, as the Health Fund Board does, this is a way to get to a high-performing healthcare system, and it's necessary to improve the health of all Oregonians. It's an example that of where we can better coordinate healthcare treatments, not only in the clinical setting, but even at a person's home. And it really assists the providers to provide the level of care desired by the patient. We all have high hopes for electronic health records as being our means of better communication. But interaction with the emergency medical system isn't even designed into most of those early efforts at this time. And this is really the first way of trying to integrate that care. Studies have shown that there's often a lack of communication even amongst the provider and the patient, and this is yet another means to get that information shared. And as the Health Fund Board and its delivery committee looked at this over the last year, you often heard a lot of discussions about a patient-centered medical home and what we can do to enhance communication and care coordination. A medical home tries to get the right care to a person at the right time and in the right place, especially between the clinic and the hospital setting. Advanced care information, such as in the Pulse, needs to be available to the right people at the right time, with the services organized to provide the chosen level of medical intervention. This registry is a community-wide, comprehensive approach that puts a system in place to ensure the wishes are actually honored wherever the person is. I don't know what could be a more critical, important time for our healthcare system to be truly patient-centered, but at the end of life. DHS would oversee the efforts to implement this statewide Pulse registry. The expectation is that the department would contract with OHSU, build on the existing structure already being piloted, to develop and implement and maintain the registry. And under the agency's public health authority, the registry would be aligned with federal HIPAA provisions that allow the safe and secure collection and dissemination of identifiable health information for the health of the population, a critical ability for this registry to function beyond a small pilot and serve all Oregonians. The department already has experience with the administration of statewide health-related registries, such as the cancer registry and the immunization registry, which I would say the immunization registry is invaluable to physicians currently. The registry is included in the governor's recommended budget, and it has a fiscal impact, and I want to point out that in Section 10 there is a typo. The dollar value there is for total funds, $740,000 in total funds. So we really only need $451,000 general fund, because we believe we can get federal matching funds to lower the cost of this. Oregon's been a leader in the country for dignified end-of-life care, and it's devoted significant efforts over the past 20 years to make an individual's preferences be honored. And the partnership of this public-private partnership is critical to make this go forward, and the Oregon Health Fund Board believes this is an important first next step to improve Oregon's healthcare delivery system.
Thank you very much. We have about 10 minutes left, and we still have three people on the queue. And Senator Johnson, did you also want to testify?
Yes.
But would you three still stay here? We'll let Senator Johnson testify, then she can leave.
Yes.
And then you can. Yeah, and Senator Bates, go on down there, too.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I'm the state senator from District 16. In the interest of full disclosure, I knew Mrs. Hirsch, who was in the video. I also, in my private life, am a financial supporter of the Center for Ethics and serve on a couple of boards up at OHSU. This is going to be difficult testimony for me, as my mother's death remains very fresh in my memory. I came here, however, knowing how supportive she was of Dr. Toll, the Center for Ethics, and the concept of the Pulse. Mother was a publicly elected board member of a district hospital until very close to the end of her life at age 93. She intellectually understood the value of a clear expression of end-of-life wishes for the hospital, for the first responders, and for the patient. In the last weeks of her life, she executed a Pulse. The existence of the Pulse brought enormous comfort to her, knowing that her wishes would be honored, and it brought confidence to me as her power of attorney, because I knew it was a clear articulation of her instructions at a time of medical crisis. I had watched my mother and her doctor go thoroughly through every element of the Pulse document, culminating in her doctor's signature on the form, thereby memorializing her wishes as a doctor's order. No misunderstanding, no coercion, no opportunity for a tragic mistake about exactly what her end-of-life wishes were. The only drawback to the bright pink pulsed form is that sometimes it resides taped to the refrigerator, easy to forget when the patient is in extremis and the ambulance crew is moving fast. This bill is the first step towards an expanded pulse program and eventually a statewide electronic pulse, so that no EMT is in the position of literally crushing the ribcage of a sick old lady, trying his best to revive her against her express wishes. Eventually, an EMT would have on his computer real-time data about real-time end-of-life wishes. The bill does have a fiscal, and as we all know, these are difficult financial times. I would nevertheless submit to you that this program is critically important, and I hope that the committee moves it forward to continue the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Johnson, so much.
Dr. Bates?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Alan Bates, Senator from District 3 and a family physician in Southern Oregon. I'll make my comments short. You've heard a lot of this already. Medical science has, frankly, in many areas, outstripped our moral codes. We now have the ability to keep people alive who do not want to be kept alive and do things to people they don't want done to them. When I was in medical school many, many years ago, the basic philosophy was the doctor knows best. He will tell you what's right for you, what's wrong for you, and you will follow his orders. Thank goodness that has changed. We now believe that patients have a right to make decisions that affect their lives, and that we should support those rights after we've given our best advice to them. And that is what this pulse form is all about. We are developing a system in healthcare, hopefully, that is patient-centered, so people have control of the most important decisions in life, which, from my point of view, are when you die and how you die sometimes. The pulse form that we've all been kind of familiar with now in the committee, and many of us have seen for many years, has been adopted by many states across the nation and was pioneered here in Oregon. The next step in doing this, of course, is making it something that really works the way we want it to in a much more reasonable fashion. Frankly, I've got one of these at my house. I have found out that my refrigerator no longer has stickies on it that work because there's stainless steel. They don't have magnets anymore. Mine fell off. I can't find it. I looked for it this last week and had to fill a new one out. This is a real problem. And so this bill, will resolve that issue for us. And there's two places it's going to be important. One is for the EMTs that you've heard about, when the first responders when they get to the site. There's another place that's also equally important. This is one that most physicians, I think, have to deal with. That's the patient who is presented to the emergency room who is comatose. In other words, their heart's beating, they're still breathing, but they can't communicate with us, and we don't know what their wishes are. Most of these people have suffered a stroke or something of that nature, and so we go ahead and do everything. When in fact we find out a few days later, they didn't want everything done, and we should have let nature take its course. And that is a problem, I think, for many physicians, especially ER doctors. I've had to face that many times myself with the patients. The issue then becomes turning off all that afterwards, which is heartbreaking for patients' families. You'll have people come in from all over the country. There often is conflict in the family over it. One member wanting to turn everything off, the other one not wanting to turn it off. It can take days, and I've seen it take weeks to make that decision, when the decision should have been in the first place not to start those procedures. So this is a vital step to take as far as our healthcare delivery system is concerned, and I hope the committee will move it forward quickly and bring it down to the next step, which I believe might be Ways and Means, which I chair. Just coincidence. Not that I'm prejudiced about this. But I think it's something we need to move forward. And I appreciate your time, and I'll close there.
All right. Thank you very much. Before we have questions, let's quickly get, we have about 4 minutes left, Andy Miller, Dave Fiskum, and Linnea, is it Sachs? You're not going to? This one. Okay. Andy Miller, Dave Fiskum.
Madam Chair, would you like me to start?
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Andy Miller, Senior Policy Analyst, Oregon Business Association. Oregon Business Association advocates for long-term enhancement of Oregon's business environment and quality of life. Our members include businesses of all sizes and industries throughout the state, from our largest farm to two Fortune 500 companies. OBA believes that comprehensive health care reform is necessary and desirable. We support increased access to basic health care, including coverage for children and expanding OHP standards. This has been our position in both this session and the 2007 session. We acknowledge that the costs of health care are simply too high and that any expansion of coverage without reducing the cost trend is unsustainable. Without effective approaches to containing costs and bending the health care cost curve, there will be limited political support for broader reforms, including expanding access. To address that crisis in health care, both long- and short-term steps are necessary. The Oregon Health Fund Board has identified a coordinated strategy to control costs and improve outcomes for all Oregonians. A measure that has potential for both short-term and long-term impact on costs is the electronic pulse for first responders. The pulse form provides a way to ensure that patients' wishes about life-sustaining treatment are known and followed. Creating a statewide registry for collection and dissemination of pulse will ensure the availability of the form at the time it is needed. OBA supports Senate Bill 451 creating this registry and the Oregon Pulse Registry Advisory Committee. We believe that this is part of a system innovation needed to improve care and reduce costs. And I have personal experience with the pulse, and it's a very important program.
Thank you. Mr. Fiskin.
Madam Chair, committee members, forgive me for being outside the room. I'm assuming we're talking about Senate Bill 451 this morning.
Yes, we are.
Thank you. I've been instructed by my client, Providence Health System, to appear today, and I'll be very brief in light of what I know to be your busy schedule for the rest of the morning to endorse Senate Bill 451. We did so as well on the comparator bill on the House side, relying on advice and counsel internally from the Father John Tuohy, who is the chair of the Providence Center for Healthcare Ethics in the House. We raised some questions about this, not with an eye toward opposing the bill, but more with an eye to improving it. Since the time of the House hearing, our experts have been in touch with the task force that helped to write the bill, and we're pleased to report that the ideas we expressed, the concerns we expressed in the House, have in fact already been adopted into the design of the registry. Thus, we have no further suggestions, and in fact, we support the bill as written. I should add that the price tag, it's, I believe, is embedded in the bill of $700,000+ may be too high, it may be less than that, and I hope that you will see your way clear to send this bill to Ways and Means so it can compete for a tight time for investments down there. I think it's an important bill, and Providence wanted me to make sure I registered our view this morning. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll stop and answer questions.
Thank you, and I also would like to read into the record that our staff that we have testimony from the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems that was submitted, I believe, by Gwen Dayton, and then another letter from AARP also supporting the bill. So, colleagues, do you have any questions for any of the panels? It looks like we don't, and so we cannot move the bill today because we do not have the fiscal. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, Madam Chair, not a question. I would suggest that that amendment might be appropriate because I don't think we need this all to be directed out of the general fund. So maybe an amendment to allow other funds or limitations. I'm sure Senator Bates could come up with the appropriate language and might as well amend it here before we send it out, I would think. Madam Chair, Pulse existed before the Health Fund Board, clearly, and I have been interested in this back in, starting in 99, conversations I had with Governor Kitzhaber about end-of-life care have been rather significant over time. And I guarantee you that John would be fully supportive of this. And this is a major step in the right direction. I think we have all at some point in our lives had to deal with a parent or a grandparent or somebody who ended up in a condition, and then we have to make the tough choice and not necessarily knowing what their wishes are. you know, ultimately it comes down to quality of life issues. And I think this is a major step. I'm fully supportive of it, but I do think we need to make that amendment on the funding piece of it.
Why don't you and Senator Bates commiserate on this or discuss any possibilities? Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a suggestion to make certain that this is perceived by the public in the right way it's intended. Physician orders does not necessarily send the message that we're wanting. It's really patient-ordered life-sustaining treatment. Just a thought.
Thank you.
And I think it's a great thought.
Very good thought.
That is good.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much for coming, and we will wait to see what comes from Senator Cruz and Senator Bates. Share that with the proponents of the bill. Basically, I think we will be sharing it with Dr. Toll, Dr. Schmidt, and Dr. Smith. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on... Oh, and before I close, Mr. Shook, would you make sure that these guys do what they said they're going to do?
That's a very tough task.
Okay. We've met before, so.
Right. Then I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 451, and I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 24. And while Dr. Miles Ellenby, Doug Romer, and Kim Hoffman, if you'd come forward, and Mr. Shook, would you please describe the bill?
Madam Chair, I'd like to say that the two amigos are still two for three, and I'm working on the three yet, so we got a chance to be three for three here for you.
Okay.
That would be good.
Yeah, we're close, okay?
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 24 requires health benefit plans to provide coverage of medically necessary, evidence-based telemedical health services if the health service is otherwise covered by the benefit plan.
Colleagues, this bill we've been working on this issue for a long, long time, and we did have a wonderful interim group that worked on this, and you're going to be hearing from them and what's come out. The bill actually came out of that interim committee. So, with that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kim Hoffman. I am the telehealth coordinator for OHSU, and I'm speaking to you today as the chair of the Telehealth Alliance of Oregon. We would like to begin the session by sharing with you some of the things that are happening in the areas of telemedicine in Oregon today. The Telehealth Alliance of Oregon has been working for the last number of years to expand telemedicine services throughout Oregon. And with today's healthcare shortages, it's becoming even more important. We've discovered a couple of the challenges have to do with access to high-speed connectivity, which is actually being addressed right now with the development of the Oregon Health Network. The other challenge has been reimbursement for telemedicine services. And hopefully Senate Bill 24 will help address those issues. We're doing quite a bit of telemedicine in Oregon today already. There's a high number of image transfers going on, pediatric cardiology, adult cardiology, pediatric radiology, CTs, MRIs, all kinds of things, sometimes for specialists to be able to do interpretations, and sometimes when patients are being transferred between facilities so that the receiving facility can be better prepared to take care of the patient when they arrive, and also avoid duplicate tests. OHSU has been doing telepsychiatry with Snake River Prison in Ontario for some time now, and with the Yellowhawk Tribal Clinic in Umatilla under Dr. Knight Richardson, and I know he wants to expand that program. OHSU CDRC Clinic has been providing telegenetics clinics to patients in Medford, Bend, and Boise, Idaho, so that patients don't have to travel to Portland to see geneticists or wait the 3 to 6 months for the geneticists to come to their community. In addition, we have some pretty remarkable programs going on that Dr. Miles Ellenby and Doug Rimmer are going to share with you. Dr. Miles Ellenby is a pediatric intensivist at OHSU, and we'll be talking about OHSU's PICU consult program. And Doug Romer is from Grand Ronde Hospital in La Grande, and we'll be telling you about his hospital's telemedicine efforts. Miles?
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Miles Ellenby. I'm a pediatric ICU doctor at Dornbecker Children's Hospital in Portland, and I'm presenting on behalf of OHSU and the Telehealth Alliance of Oregon in support of State Bill 24. Thank you for the opportunity to share with you our experience providing telemedicine consults for critically ill children in Eugene. the handful of slides and a brief movie to present. First, I'd like to describe the landscape that we practice in as pediatric ICUs in the state of Oregon. The entire state has only two certified pediatric ICUs, staffed by 13 intensivists and containing 36 beds, a very limited resource, especially from a geographic standpoint, considering that both of the PICUs are located in Portland within 5 miles of each other at OHSU and Emmanuel. This map shows the situation. The PICUs are identified by the red dots. Outside of Portland, the nearest units to the north are in Seattle and Tacoma, to the east in Boise and Salt Lake City, and to our south in Sacramento and Reno. This geography creates a large catchment area for the two children's hospitals and a significant limitation for access to care for the children of our state. In fact, Dornbecker now transports more than 800 infants and children every year to Portland. I'd like to briefly explain the role that we as pediatric intensivists play in the care of these children. We receive calls throughout the day and night from community hospitals seeking advice when a sick child rolls into their ER. It's important to recognize that many of these smaller hospitals may only see a few critically ill children every year, and when they do show up, it can create a great deal of anxiety. You can often hear it in their voices on the other end of the phone. The dilemma that we face is to make a decision with the referring provider about whether or not to transport the child to Portland. We depend on the ability of the remote team to both properly assess that child and then to communicate that assessment to us over the phone. And while we know from the data that many of these kids could be safely cared for in their community hospitals, if there is any question on either side of the call, we often default to transporting the child, either by ground ambulance, by airplane, or in emergent conditions, by helicopter. Unfortunately, oftentimes, the child is unnecessarily transported at great expense to many. The impact of this decision is widespread. Obviously, and most importantly, the care the child receives can be dramatically affected. Transporting the child also places a significant hardship on the parents, who are removed from their community, their support systems, their other children, their jobs, and so forth. And in the winter, when the winds are blowing and the roads are icy, both the patient and our transport team are put at significant risk on the roads. Additionally, the financial impacts are great, with hits to the healthcare system, the payers, the family, and their local economies. As an example, the cost of just the medical transport by ground from Eugene is in excess of $6,000, and up to a shocking $21,000 for a plane ride from Klamath Falls. So, is there a way to help with this dilemma that could not only provide an improved quality of care, but also reduce potentially dangerous and oftentimes unnecessary transports with cost savings to all? Well, I wouldn't be here today if I didn't feel so passionately about telemedicine and its ability to help in these acute situations. Here I am on the monitor in the PICU at Dornbecker in Portland, connecting with Dr. Tom Rowe at Sacred Heart in Eugene by telemedicine. Making sure to avoid any privacy concerns, we're discussing the care of this critically ill, HIPAA-compliant teddy bear. Studies have shown that my ability to make a good clinical decision is dramatically improved by being able to see the child in real time with live streaming video. I can better help the community doc assess the child, initiate care, and ultimately make the important transport decision. The quality and timeliness of care is improved, geographic constraints to access are lessened, and dollars can be saved. Or in other words, as a pediatric intensivist, a telephone call can be helpful, a picture is worth a thousand words, but these acute situations, live interactive video is really priceless. My apologies to MasterCard. It really does make all the difference in the world on both ends of the call. Now, I'd like to briefly describe our current program with Sacred Heart and Eugene. We've been doing telemedicine for just under 2 years, having seen now 33 children by telemedicine. There was another last week after these slides were prepared. 21 of these children did need to be transported up to Dornbecker, but now 12 kids have been able to safely stay in Eugene. The rolling machines that provide the telemedicine can be used in 6 different units there at both the original campus and now the new Riverbend Hospital, including both emergency rooms, the pediatric ward, and nursery. Doctors on both sides are becoming increasingly comfortable with the technology and are using it with increasing frequency. Finally, I'd like to tell you about three illustrative cases, each highlighting a different benefit of telemedicine. First is the story of a two-month-old baby who is being cared for in Eugene with a case of viral bronchiolitis, a common wintertime malady for infants. He was recovering, and his pediatrician had ordered a routine chest x-ray to assess his lungs. After departing the hospital for his clinic, the pediatrician received an urgent call from the radiologists that the baby had a very large pneumothorax, an unusual and potentially life-threatening complication if not urgently addressed. Unable to quickly get back to the hospital, the pediatrician called for an emergent transport, prompting a telemedicine consult to one of my partners, Dr. Brainer. On the screen was live video of a fairly well-appearing infant, completely inconsistent with the chest x-ray findings. Another film was ordered. It was entirely normal. Our transport team was stood down, dollars were saved, and the baby was discharged home a few days later from Sacred Heart. The second case is about a four-year-old girl with leukemia who developed Lyme sepsis, an overwhelming and potentially fatal bloodstream infection. In fact, she coded in the Sacred Heart emergency room and required CPR, all being guided remotely by another one of my partners, Dr. Graham, via telemedicine. Everyone there, including the child's parents, were relieved to have him virtually there with them. He had asked the team in Eugene to give a flash bolus of IV fluids as part of the resuscitation. A few minutes later, he was able to see on the monitor that the fluids were only slowly dripping in. He instructed them, "No, what I meant was to push the fluids rapidly." A small observation that might have changed the outcome. A small observation completely that not possible without telemedicine. I'm happy to report that she was successfully resuscitated, transported up to Dornbecker, and made a full recovery after a 17-day hospitalization. And finally, I'd like to share the story of an 8-month-old that presented to Sacred Heart with symptoms of progressive hypotonia, lethargy, and being, quote, cross-eyed. Workup initiated at Sacred Heart made the diagnosis of meningitis. A telemedicine consult was performed. It happened to be our first one, and I was on call that evening. It was an easy decision to transport the child as he was rapidly worsening, and we were concerned that he might lose the ability to protect his airway, need to be intubated, and placed on a ventilator. Our PANDA transport team was dispatched by ground. 30 minutes after departure, we received an urgent cell phone call from the nurses at Sacred Heart, concerned that the infant's neurologic exam had worsened. Their doctor had already departed for home. To further complicate the situation, all the phone lines into Sacred Heart were down due to some scheduled maintenance that had gone awry. Their nurses were now requesting an emergent helicopter transport. While I couldn't reach Sacred Heart by phone, I did connect with the telemedicine equipment, and it worked flawlessly. I was able to lead the nurses through a detailed neuro exam, even able to check his pupil's response to light. The resolution was phenomenal. I was able to reassure them that the neuro exam was, in fact, unchanged from the one I had done previously. The transport continued by ground uneventfully, saving the child, our team, and the system an unnecessary helicopter transport. The outcome? A 16-day hospitalization at Dornbecker, after which he made a full recovery. But I'll let you be the judge of that, as his mother has graciously agreed to tape the following video about her experience, as the first of our telemedicine patients. She highlights a number of the important benefits of telemedicine to this underserved population in the state.
It started on a Thursday. He was getting really tired and cranky. I thought that was strange, so we took him into the doctor, and he had no fever or anything. So we took him home, and he just slept a lot that day. And then by the next day, which was a Friday, he was just sleeping and didn't want to eat. He wasn't moving or anything. When we picked him up, he would cry, and his head was like a newborn baby's. And he was about 8 months old. So that was very concerning. So we called the doctor's office, and they said, long story short, they said to bring him in. When I was getting him ready, my oldest daughter saw that his eyes had rolled to the back of his head, and he went cross-eyed and everything. And so that concerned me. So I called the doctor's office, and I said I wanted to be seen right away. When we got there, his normal doctor said, okay, we need to take him to the hospital. And so she called 911, and brought him here and had all these different tests done. So they used the new telemedicine thing. And it was really neat because the doctor, I could see the doctor, and he could see Zachary, and he could even see, like, the camera, you saw it turn, and he could even see the like what his pulse was reading at and everything else, which I thought was really neat. He could talk to me directly and ask me questions about what was going on and everything. So it was really neat. It was really when the doctor in Portland saw that his head, when he was sat up, went like flying backwards, that he had to be taken to Portland. So that really helped, because I don't think on the phone you could really, you know, say what was happening. Now looking back, it's really neat that he was the first one. It was very nice to see the doctor that's going to, you know, meet us up there.
We're currently in the process of applying for...
Started on the Thursday.
Sorry about that. Long enough the first time. We're in the process of applying for federal funding currently to expand our program, including sites in Roseburg, Klamath Falls, Coos Bay, and Hermiston. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify before you today. I'd be happy to answer any questions after Mr. Romer presents about the program in LeGrand. Thank you.
Mr. Romer.
Can you give me up?
Yeah.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much for allowing me to participate this morning. I'm Doug Romer. I'm the Executive Director of Patient Care at Grand Ronde Hospital. Grand Ronde Hospital is a 25-bed critical access hospital in Northeast Oregon. And boy, have we had a winter. Our hospital has been isolated several times this winter. Both the freeways going east and west have been closed, and if it weren't for telemedicine, we would have been in some very serious difficulties. I just put up here a slide about our mission and vision statement, and it's interesting. This mission and vision statement is just Grand Ronde Hospital's mission and vision statement, but it highlights the telemedicine mission of Grand Ronde Hospital so well. It has to do with access to care, technology, and emphasis on community need. And our community needs access to specialist medical care, just like everyone does. We are fortunate enough to have a relationship with St. Alphonsus Regional Medical Center, which is in Boise. Boise is closer to LeGrand than Portland is, and therefore, for transportation time, it's best that we use them for a primary referral center. Secondarily, the availability of a research project that St. Alphonsus has for telemedicine and us doing some research with them has allowed us to move forward very quickly with telemedicine projects. What we're using for telemedicine is the InTouch system, RP7 InTouch system, and I would like to show a video about that, because seeing is believing. This film was shown at filmed at Grand Ronde Hospital and St. Alphonsus.
A specialist to create a remote presence, as it were, allows the physician quite a distance away to be able to evaluate the patient, to interact with the care providers in a rural or community healthcare site, in order for the specialist to work with the primary care provider to improve care for that patient. It's really about bringing urban medicine into a rural setting.
with the wireless technology that we have here, this RP7 remote presence device can go anywhere in the hospital. You don't have to plug it in. It goes right into the patient rooms, right into the nursery, right into the ICU, and takes care of business.
I was introduced to InTouch and have used the robotics here for several months. And the things that I like about it primarily have to do with communication. I can communicate with colleagues off-site. If I need advice during surgery, I can call somebody and get some help during the operation. I can communicate with families during an operation, tell them that things are going okay, that the operation is progressing the way that we expected, and put their mind at ease a little bit.
This technology in many different ways. We can use it for cardiology, neurology, mental health, pulmonology, ICU, intensivists. There's a whole wealth of possibilities for this remote presence wireless device.
The beauty of the InTouch system and the laptop I have is that I really can be just about anywhere, and as long as I have wireless access, then I can log into my computer, so theoretically I could be on the beach or in the mountains and still be able to use this technology if I had wireless access.
The robot is valuable in any circumstance in which a second opinion or an additional source of input would be valuable. And so a general surgeon seeing something in an operation that he or she didn't anticipate, being able to have a specialist, a surgeon who has had experience in doing large numbers of unusual operations, could be able to beam in and offer input, offer advice. This is how you should proceed. This is a circumstance I think that you're encountering right now, one I've seen many times, but perhaps you haven't.
I was able to share a very special moment recently. I was asked to bring the robot into a patient room of a mother who just delivered the day before. That baby had to be flown to Boise for neonatology services. We were able to bring the robot into the room, and that mom could connect with her baby 300 miles away.
So far, the response has been very, very positive. And the first time I actually tried it with one of my own patients who had a baby in the NICU, and I took the robot out to come and visit her and the baby, but I was still remotely in my office. Her response was, this is just so awesome. And I think we're dealing with a group of patients in an age group where they are very comfortable with technology.
So with cellular tech, you can communicate with your patients or nursing staff from any place, to any place. A couple of weeks ago, I was talking to a surgeon in Argentina, and not just talking to him, but actually seeing each other. It's really stunning. Stunning is a good word.
I think we're just beginning to realize the magnitude of what we can do using the RP7 remote presence device.
But the problem has always been reimbursement. So let's have the next panel up to talk about reimbursement. The only reason we haven't been able to get anywhere is because we really haven't been able to address that reimbursement problem. So with that, I'd like to ask Catherine Britton, Jackie Rice, and Dr. Mark O'Halloran up to testify
And this is probably where the questions.
Robot was R2-D2. Is that
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kathy Britton. I chaired the work group for the Telehealth Alliance of Oregon that put this bill together for you. We thought that pictures were probably told a far better story than our description of services, and wanted you to have that opportunity. We have crafted a bill that you have in front of you that is fairly straightforward and explanatory, and I'm not going to beat you down with the specific points of it. Basically, we are asking that private payers reimburse for telemedicine services if they are currently covered in person in their plans, and if the providers providing them are currently covered in their plans. We're not asking them to pay for anything that they don't currently pay for. We're not asking them to expand services. We're simply asking them to treat telemedicine services the same that as they would for in-person. The thing I want to stress is that we've tried several times to reach reimbursement agreement for private payers and have not been very successful. And this is a very difficult task. In the time that I've been working in telemedicine, which has been a number of years, we've only been successful at getting five states to adopt private payer reimbursement. So it's not easy. But I think we did the right thing in having everyone at the table, everyone working together, payers, providers, the Department of Consumer and Business Affairs, everyone with a vested stake in this. We didn't always agree, but we always respected each other, and we always looked at the good rather than the perfect. So what we're bringing you today is not a perfect bill. It's a good bill. It's a good enough bill. It's a bill that will allow us to move forward. We have been made aware that there are several glitches in the bill that we need to work out, and we've agreed with Senator Mona Sanderson to do that. And so we want this to happen this time, and we want it to happen in a way that everyone is comfortable, and maybe not satisfied, but comfortable. And so we ask that you consider this bill before you and allow us to work with you to move forward. I'm going to turn my time over now to two other folks who worked with the committee to see that this bill got crafted, to allow them to make their remarks.
Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, thank you for hearing our testimony today. My name is Jackie Rice. I'm the Interim Regional Vice President for Strategy, Innovation, and Development at Peace Health. We have hospitals in Eugene, Springfield, Florence, Cottage Grove, and we are using telemedicine to connect patients in Alaska to specialists in Eugene, as well as patients in Springfield to specialists in Portland, which is the Dornbecker Sacred Heart pilot you just heard Dr. Ellenby describe. Why we're so interested? Well, before the pilot that Dr. Ellenby talked about, we, for a two-year period, 58 children were transferred from Eugene to Dornbecker and Legacy, and 17 of those could have been avoided with telemedicine as we've gone back and reviewed their charts. The study that Dr. Ellenby described, I won't go through all that data again, he talked about it, but each of those ground transports were approximately 6,500. So we in effect saved 12 transports for 6,500, which is a cost to the health system, and there are many costs for the family and the effect on the family that's saved. There were bills considered in 2007 and 2008. The language would have meant that this pilot could not have qualified for reimbursement. They would have dramatically curtailed reimbursement to specialists and made it difficult for Sacred Heart to move forward. There were two flaws in those. They limited telemedicine to medically underserved areas, geographic areas where there's a shortage of specialists, and they prohibited the use of telemedicine when a face-to-face is available within a reasonable distance. Enacting language like that would mean we'd still be transporting the kids up I-5 as we have done in the past. So we participated in the work group that Kathy Britton described just now, which was established by Senator Montes Anderson and the Telehealth Alliance of Oregon. We feel that we understand each other much better, the payers and providers, and we're happy to support Senate Bill 24 and are happy to participate in any further work groups or work that's assigned by the committee. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you very much.
My name is Dr. Marco Hollerin. I'm Director of Clinical Outreach for OHSU Healthcare System. And my job right now is to travel throughout the state and literally to all four corners, from Enterprise to Jordan Valley to Brookings up to Astoria and most sites in between, and to try and ascertain what some of the healthcare needs are and how OHSU can help address those needs. There is a resoundingly consistent message that emanates from everywhere in the state, and especially in rural areas, where physician workforce and manpower is the number one issue. We simply don't have enough doctors to take care of everyone, and the situation is worsening. I think we are, as a backdrop to why this telemedicine legislation is so important, we're, I think, entering into the perfect storm right now, in that we have an aging workforce of physicians. We have an aging population where our baby boomers are now entering into that part of their life where they will need more health care. And we simply don't have the ability to deliver care to all those people. Also, the structure of healthcare is changing in that many more physicians now are entering into employment relationships with larger organizations, and those tend to reside in cities. New physicians coming out really are not as interested, coming out of our residency programs and fellowship programs, in going into private practice, especially in small towns. And so when I was now down at the Southern Oregon coast with Dr. Joe Robertson, president of OHSU, we now see people moving out of communities, and the stated reason is we don't have access to good enough health care. And so that is going to now become one of the factors that families use, I predict, over the next 10 years, and as well as people who are going to retire to an area and make a decision that what is the health care access? And if the access isn't there, they will choose not to move there. That will affect communities, employers, tax base, et cetera. And so as we look at new and innovative ways to address this, we simply can't train enough physicians to meet this demand. We have to start thinking new thoughts. And I think the telemedicine technology that you saw here today is one of the ways in which we can expand access to specialty care and also expand care to remote areas. If we look at trying to make it work, physicians right now are having a hard time. They're burning out in record numbers. Stress-related disability has never been higher among physicians, and the hassle factor of practicing medicine right now, the paperwork burden, whatever malpractice risks they may have, when you add it all together, if you bring something new to physicians, especially busy primary care physicians in smaller towns, they're just not going to do it unless it's something that works for them, is user-friendly, and in which they can be reimbursed for their time because of their own increasing expenses of running a practice. And so I was extremely impressed with the collaborative nature of this work group to try and bring payers together with providers and health systems, as well as information technology experts, to try to come up with a way to do this that was workable, that actually physicians would use, and that payers would partner with, as opposed to getting into an adversarial relationship with. If physicians aren't paid for telemedicine, the things that you saw just won't happen. Much of that is currently supported by grant support, and so we need to have have a vehicle in which this technology can be moved to the next level, in which this becomes routine, and that we can keep people out of the hospital, keep them close to home where they're not having to leave work or their farm or anything to drive 200 miles for a doctor's visit. This can work. It doesn't work in all specialties, but it works in many specialties. Dr. Norwood Knight Richardson, who also supports this bill, is currently down in New Orleans seeing Katrina victims that he sees with telemedicine and does telepsychiatry to help them with post-traumatic stress and everything as a result of that. He goes down and sees them once a year in person and does interim follow-up using telemedicine. This is the kind of thing that we can do where people can be seen in person and then followed up using telemedicine and keep people at work, at home, in their own communities, and expand the care that's available within people's local communities. So I appreciate support of this bill very much. I think it's extremely important as we move forward, try to conserve our scarce resources for healthcare using this technology. And I'd be happy to take questions.
There are a couple of people that had come to me that were very concerned that psychologists or psychiatrists weren't covered. And would you please address that issue, Kathy?
I'd be happy to. Psychiatrists are absolutely covered, as you see in the list that we put together, and the list is one of the problematic pieces, but physicians of any sort would be covered if they're covered under a health benefit plan. Clinical psychologists are the same. They would be covered if they are covered under a health benefit plan. The concern I think that the clinical psychologist had, and I forgive me if I don't speak appropriately for them, was that there is some artifact in language on in section 3 under number 4 about individual psychotherapy that includes medical evaluation and medical management would be precluded from reimbursement. And that's Medicare language because many states have differing rules about whether clinical psychologists and clinical social workers can prepare script and provide medication management. Medicare put that in. We are very willing to work with the clinical psychologists to work out language that is more directed towards their practice and their scope of practice in the state. Obviously, health benefit plan payers are not going to pay for anything that's outside of their scope of practice, and so that again becomes the decision for them. But we do understand, and we are cognizant of the need to make that clearer.
Okay. We're running out of time, but I do want to get at least very, we're going to run over till about 10:15, I think, colleagues. So with that, unless, are there questions for these people at this point in time? All right. Thank Let's you. Bring up Kim Wirtz and John Powell.
Madam Chair, I'd just like to say my biggest disappointment with this bill is the relating clause is too narrow to put tort reform in it. But
that would kill it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. For those of you who were on this committee last session, you know we testified in favor of a telemedicine bill last session, as we will today. And Ms. Wirtz will present the Regents' testimony. And Kim, I think the Chair, from looks at her eyebrows, wants you to abbreviate your testimony.
I will be brief. Chair Monica Anderson, members of the committee.
Especially since they're going to be amendments.
Yes. Absolutely.
And we're going to be...
Regents appreciated the opportunity to work with the group in developing these rules, and we have just a couple of key issues. First, you usually hear us talk about the cost of mandates and how we oppose mandates for that reason, and this particular bill is one we can support as long as it retains the medical necessity of the services provided. We strongly urge that the administrative rule, that the mandate be written so that administrative rules are unnecessary. If it's clear that the services are covered based on the terms of the contract and the providers covered by the contract, it makes it simple for individual consumers to understand as well as speeds implementation. We believe that working with the committee to amend the bill and streamline will result in a bill that we can support entirely as it goes forward.
Excellent.
Thank you.
All right. And will you work with the proponents, Kathy and Kim, and then Mr. Shook, to make sure all of the amendments come in?
Thank you.
Thank you. With that, let's call Dr. Brian Hartman, Linnea Saris, Nellie DeVries.
Good morning, Madam Chairwoman and committee members. My name is Dr. Brian Hartman, and I am a licensed psychologist. I'm currently the only deaf psychologist in Oregon. I am assisted today by my interpreters, Kendra Moon-Cotney and Anna Chimber. The Oregon Psychological Association is standing against SB 24 as it is currently written, which mandates reimbursement for telemedicine services. As previously noted, we have central concerns about this bill, and that, as it is written, has a critical flaw. And that flaw is found in Section 3, Part 4, where it states individual psychotherapy that includes medical evaluation or medical management services provided by a clinical psychologist or clinical social worker is not subject to subsection 1 of this section. Subsection 1 being the area where the mandate for insurance reimbursement is located. Simply put, the section essentially eliminates reimbursement for psychologists and social workers utilizing telemedicine to provide individual psychotherapy, a practice within the scope of practice for both psychologists and social workers. As written, this bill does not satisfy the standards of ethical care for Oregonians and could potentially make services to some prohibitive. A critical example of that, of how that could prohibit services to some individuals is within the deaf and hard of hearing community, which is a very much underserved community. Utilizing prevalence data of deafness and mental illness, there are currently an estimated 7,466 deaf Oregonians with a diagnosable mental illness within the course of a given year. Within Oregon, there are two mental health providers who specialize in this population, 2 to 7,500. One is a psychologist, myself, and the other is a social worker. I'm sure that you can see the problematic issue already. The use of telemedicine has been proposed by myself and this other social worker to the Department of Human Services as a way by which some of the service inequities to this underserved group could be mitigated. Video conferencing technology is widely available to many deaf individuals and is now the preferred way for many to use the phone, as this technology allows us to use a natural language, American Sign Language. How this relates to telemedicine, particularly psychotherapy, is simple. It shows that the technology is already there and present for deaf individuals across the state to be connected with the professionals who can provide them with culturally and linguistically competent services. To do so, however, requires that the providers can be reimbursed for their time and expenses. Passing SB 24 as currently written would provide a blow to potential accessibility for deaf and hard of hearing mental health consumers who already have numerous barriers to treatment. In summary, the Oregon Psychological Association opposes SB 24 as it ignores parity legislation and restricts service access for an already underserved population. Telemedicine done correctly is a step forward in removing disparities, but only if done fairly and across all aspects of healthcare. We understand that mental health treatment by psychologists and social workers under their scope of practices were intended to be included, as has been previously mentioned today. However, we believe that the language needs to be clearer under the proposed bill. We would be happy to work with the proponents and the committee to determine that language.
And we hear your concern. We have had, it's taken a long time for us to get this far. And it doesn't mean that in the future we will try to go further. But I think that it will be very important for you to put your concerns with the proponents of the bill and see, since they've been working on this for a couple of years, actually, to see if the payers would be willing to do that this time. If not, that's all I can say. Let's just work with the proponents, okay? Thank you.
Madam Chair, Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nellie DeVries. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association, and I'm here to express our support for Senate Bill 24. However, we do request that you add one amendment simply to include optometrists to the list of healthcare professionals listed in Section 2, subsection of the bill. So if you, that's our sole request, and we are here in support of the bill. So thank you.
And again, I'll say the same thing to you. We've come a long ways in getting this far to get payers, and please voice your concerns with the proponents of the bill. I can't guarantee anything, but I think your concerns are valid, and you just need to share that with the proponents of the bill. Okay?
Thank you.
And I'd like to call up Gene Nickel, and is Nellie here? Nellie DeVries? Oh, no, that's you. I meant, who was the other one? I guess Gina Nickel is the only one. And I'd like to read into the record a letter from Commissioner Dan Saltzman from the City of Portland. The letter is on file, and he is also endorsing the bill. Okay. Gina.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Gina Nickel. I am the Executive Director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. We have been working on this issue for a number of years and are very, very supportive of telemedicine. We are supportive of Senate Bill 468, which is the bill that Senator Atkinson has dropped on request of Norwood Knight Richardson. We have worked with the proponents of this bill and would be very supportive with just a couple minor changes. Ones that we have already talked about but wanted to bring before you today. One is that in Section 2 that we add a qualified mental health professional who provides services in a community mental health center that is covered by parity. Also to add a certified addictions professional, which is also covered under parity.
Gina, are there contracts now set up where that's covered?
That is correct. The issue is being able to use telemedicine for that.
Yes, and that where we've got is getting the contracts, and so the contracts that you set up with the carriers is the key, at least this legislation.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you, Gina. All right. Are there specific questions before we move on? Today is Oregon Medical. Thank you, Gina. I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 24. And Mr. Shirk, please be sure to keep in contact with Kim and Kathy, and the people need to are interested in changes to be working with Mr. Shirk, because he'll know how to get a hold of Kathy and Kim. All right. With that, I think I close the public hearing on Senate Bill 24, and I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 509. And today is the Oregon Medical Association Day, so we have lots of physicians in the building. And I want to make sure that the nurses that are here, that we are going to be hearing SJM5. And with that, we will,
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 509, relating to physician contracts for services by imposing requirements on covered entities that obtain use of physicians' discounted rates, and on contracts between entities that contract for provision of health care services and physicians. And I'm pleased that we have experts here today that can explain that.
All right. I have here Elizabeth Schumacher, Dr. Monica, is it?
Welby,
and Jeff Baird. Jeffrey Baird. If you three would come up, please. I forgot. Elizabeth Schumacher and... Okay, if that's what you want. It's different. This one's different.
I don't know where Chair is.
Right there. Okay.
Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, my name is Monica Webby. I'm a pediatric neurosurgeon in Portland, Oregon, and I'm the current president of the Oregon Medical Association, and we are delighted that you're taking the time to hear Senate Bill 509, and we would like you very much to support our legislation. The next three speakers will give you some background information on the current problem of silent PPOs and the need to pass legislation to regulate this practice. This is a priority issue and concern for the Oregon Medical Association, and we very much appreciate you hearing our bill and encourage you to support it. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Elizabeth Schumacher. Thank you. Can you hear me? Is this working okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. My name is Elizabeth Schumacher. I'm a legislative attorney for the American Medical Association, and I specialize in managed care-related issues at the AMA. And I'm here today to support Senate Bill 509. This bill reflects model language that the AMA developed over the last few years on regulation of rental network PPOs. And this has been just an incredibly complex issue for the last few years. We started out with a model bill, and then we brought it before the National Conference of Insurance Legislators a few years ago. And at that point, a lot of insurers got engaged, and we've had a three-year dialogue trying to develop some sort of model language to address this issue. So I'm glad to say that a lot of provisions in the Oregon bill in front of you reflect a lot of the areas of agreement. This bill goes even further and is even stronger than the final NQL model bill. And I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the really great provisions of the bill and be available to answer some questions. The whole issue of regulation of rental network PPOs is a really seriously complex issue. It took me a long time to understand as much as I know now, and there's a lot more to know. But in our opinion, this bill will go very far in improving fair contracting, saving healthcare costs, and making giant leaps in healthcare transparency, eliminating a lot of the unfair contracting practices that we believe occur right now between physicians and insurers. The health insurance industry requires a lot of significant improvements in the AMA's opinion, and regulation to improve fair contracting, and managed care entities continue to take advantage, in our opinion, of physicians, leaving them with very little bargaining power. Physicians are often forced to accept unfair contracts, inaccurate payment well below what they charge for, improper interference in medical decision making, impossible administrative burdens, and medically indefensible standards. The unregulated rental network PPO market is a sophisticated system where physician contracts are not followed and transparency is often absent. As a result, many physicians are part of contracts to which they did not agree to, are paid well below the rate that they had agreed to in any original contract, and often we'll have patients come in and see them and they can't even track where the insurance contract came from to provide that patient access to the physician, leaving them often kind of, wondering, who is this insurer? I don't have an original contract with this insurer. How did this come about? So it's kind of a mess. The enactment of this law would place Oregon on the cutting edge of real advancement towards fair contracting and transparency. Just in the last 2 years, we've had a few states that have passed laws like this. Ohio, just in the last session, Ohio, Indiana, Connecticut, Florida all passed laws, and the year before that, Colorado. And in this upcoming next 2009 session, we have a lot of states introducing more versions of this model language. The secondary rental network market is an extremely complex industry, and we believe it's gone awry. I've provided the committee with a hard copy document that includes diagrams of how this market works. But briefly, the arrangement begins when a physician contracts with an entity for the delivery of healthcare services. We call that entity a contracting entity. The normal consideration in this kind of a contract between the physician and that entity is that a physician would provide a discounted rate to the contracting entity in exchange for what we call patient steerage, or access to a specific number of patients. After this occurs, the contracting entity often resells this discount, in our opinion, like a commodity, to other entities or PPOs. The resale is often done in the false name of expanding access, but often the physician already has contracts to the same patients that this discount is being resold to. While oftentimes access is expanded, often it really isn't, and it becomes a profiteering scheme. Not only do silent PPOs make money from selling a discount that they never had a legal right to, but they often resell the discount even further or lower the discount even more. I do want to make a very important distinction today, though. We're interested in focusing on the unregulated bad actors in this scenario, which are referred to as the silent PPOs, and there's a distinction between a silent PPO and a rental network PPO, both of which are in the business of selling these discounts. A rental network PPO exists to market physicians' contractually discounted rates, and they generally adhere to the language of the original physician contract with the contracting entity. A rental network PPO will primarily sell to third-party payers, insurance brokers, TPAs, third-party administrators, local and regional PPOs, and self-insured employers. Silent PPOs are another type of entity, and that's the type we're trying to get at today. A silent PPO exists when an unauthorized discounting entity, one of these entities who got an access without a legitimate contract, such as a network broker or an integrator, accesses and applies a discount without contractual authority to do so and with no notice to or authorization by the physician. These entities' sole purpose is finding and applying the lowest discounted rates. They often do not strictly adhere to the original contract language. There's widespread recognition with representatives of the insurance industry and the medical community that we have to find a way to solve this problem, and the NQIL model bill that we've worked on in the last few years gets at some major solutions that we all came to some agreement on. There are provisions of this bill that go even further that I'm sure you'll hear opposition about today as well. But we just want to say that we feel that any language getting at regulating this, the Oregon language in front of you, is a giant step forward and reflects a lot of hard work and negotiation we've done with insurance legislators across the country for the last 3 years. I mean, we did monthly teleconferences for 6 months, or weekly teleconferences for 6 months, ironing out these details. So the language in front of you reflects a lot of that. SB 509, really the big picture, I think the important things about this are, big picture, I think it will improve fair contracting and transparency, something I think we can all agree are very important aspects. And I just kind of want to walk through some of the major provisions of the legislation that I think are really important. Big picture, prohibiting unauthorized discounting entities, these bad actors who get access to a contract without legitimate authorization, without a physician's agreement to that, or access to a lower discounted rate that has absolutely no original contract connection, would be one piece. Another piece is that the model language really reinforces the importance of the original contract privity, that contract between the physician and the original contracting entity, the terms of agreement in that language. This model bill would require that any access to a discount, past that original contract, would require the original contract language to be adhered to, the agreed-upon discount, the requirements for the patient steerage, the transparency aspects, making it a lot easier for physicians, obviously, to understand how patients have gotten access to them, who the insurance companies are who are accessing them, knowing who to bill for these services, and just making sure that contracts are being followed in a correct way. The language also empowers physicians to deny discounts to non-complying entities, as I just explained a little bit, and applies these requirements to all physician entities. Some key provisions of SB 509 that I want to point out that I think are really just tremendous strides in more specific detail are, it includes clear definitions of all the entities party to a rental network contract. One of the things that we found, or we've been finding in trying to develop language on this, is there's all different terms for who these parties are who have access to these contracts. So we think having some consistent, clear language that we all agree to so we know who's who is important. Good definitions. Also requires state licensure and regulation of insurers to make sure that if there are rental networks practicing in a state or working in a state, they're authorized to do so, and we think that will help get at some quality control. A mandate that the original contract language be adhered to for any entity accessing the discount, including steerage. Limits on how downstream rental of a physician's contracted discount may be sold or may occur. So if a contract is going to be resold or if there's going to be others accessing it, lays out clear definitions on how that is supposed to work. Contract termination language that mandates any contracted entities or downstream contracts be terminated upon notice. So if there's an entity who accesses this discount and didn't have legitimate authorization, a physician can say, hey, I want to terminate this contract. I didn't agree to this. Something that doesn't exist as well as it could now. Transparency of any fees or profits made by the contracting entity. Some of these downstream silent PPOs are obviously making money off of the discount, even though they don't have, legitimate access to the original contract. We don't think that's fair, and we think that should be upfront and transparent. Limitations on unnecessary and discriminating contracting clauses. Again, this is an issue of physicians having less bargaining power and being forced to just sort of accept take-it-or-leave-it contracts. Clear language restricting unregulated, unauthorized discounting entities. Understandable contract termination language. Compliance and penalty provisions and remedies for corrective action. So if something happens, if an unauthorized entity is accessed, there's some teeth in this bill to make sure that there's a way that it's stopped and that there's a corrective action to be followed. Obviously something we think is very important. Required notice for material changes to the contract to make sure that all parties know what's going on. Responsibility placed on the contracting entity to ensure that any downstream rental contracts comply with the original requirement. We think that that entity that's on the other side of the contract between the physician and that contracting entity, level one, we think that level one entity should be responsible to make sure that if there are any violations or if they're, you know, engaging in this business, they know they're on the line to make sure they're doing things correctly. Provides physicians with the ability to object to contract amendments. Improves pre-service and post-service transparency. That's making sure that there's notice on websites, you know, notice to on identification cards, making sure that patients and physicians and everybody involved knows what the access is, who the insurer is, that sort of thing. Strict eligibility verification criteria and delegated oversight to the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services for rulemaking. So you've got that state rulemaking component. You know, in a nutshell, I know it's a lot of really technical stuff, and I'm glad to answer questions for all of you. I'm hoping the PowerPoint that I gave you or the visuals I gave you helps kind of lay it out. And I want to just kind of be available. I understand this is a complex issue, and be available for any kind of questions.
We probably will have more questions once those who are opposed to this bill come forward.
You bet.
Okay.
With that, I'll let you go. I mean, I could go on and on and on about all of the activities that are going on nationwide on this conflict between out-of-network and in-network access, the costs that are involved, transparency. You guys know the drill, being on this committee. But I just really appreciate the opportunity to be here today and to support this bill wholeheartedly. Thank you.
Thank you. And where are you from?
Chicago. I'm a Wisconsin native, though.
All right. Well, welcome to Oregon, and thank you for the work on this bill.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
You mentioned that there has been a national effort on this and that this bill goes further in some areas. I'd like to have some documents to show the difference.
Absolutely.
Between what the agreement on the national level is and where this bill is.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
I will follow up with Courtney and the Oregon Medical Association folks to give you all those details.
Okay.
Excellent.
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for giving us this opportunity to testify in front of you today. I'm Jeff Baird. I'm the administrator at Broadway Medical Clinic in Portland, and I've presented a memo that I think you all have. We are a moderately sized medical practice in Portland with 20 physicians, 110 employees, and a 76-year history of providing health care to our patients. We strive to offer a wide variety of service to all of our patients, those with commercial insurance, Medicare, Medicaid, and the underinsured. We are fortunate because our size allows us to negotiate directly with the payers. Nonetheless, we face an increasing burden of identifying, challenging, and correcting payers operating as silent PPOs. And I think she has a graph in your packet that really exemplifies the confusion and chaos. Most of these silent PPOs have no legal basis for the amount that they identify as allowed. while some payers are merely trying to access out-of-area provider panels, which I think is an important thing to have and allow, others are deliberately shortchanging physicians. The nefarious ones are taking advantage of a broken reimbursement system that forbids physicians and other healthcare providers from discussing or collaborating with one another, yet not, offers no barriers to repricing, reselling, or usurping schemes of contracts that we have made in good faith with the payers of this state. These arrangements, some legal, some illegal, are designed to fly under the radar of most practices of business operations with misleading, erroneous, or even flagrantly wrong explanation of benefits. Those are those forms you get from your insurance companies that tell you what you're responsible for, what the physician is going to get paid, and what was allowed overall. In primary care medicine, our clinic can provide care to 400 to 500 patients a day. Our claims are comparatively small in the scheme of things, and our discounts vary, making it relatively easy for payers to claim other payers' discounts, use the wrong fee schedule, or even make up their own. They're counting on us to, one, miss the discrepancy, two, accept the allowable as correct, or three, accept the allowable because it's just too costly to chase down. They know that each claim error will take hours of labor to challenge because the third-party payer system in place today is designed to examine each of these errors or mistakes at the claim level, not in the aggregate. It typically costs our clinic more in labor to correct these false adjudications, but challenge we must. 20% to 30% of our labor force at the clinic is committed just to the business side of collecting bills, collecting payment for services rendered. And that's money that we spend on not providing care to our patients. In this day and age, there is no excuse for the healthcare system, for a healthcare system that is based on complex billing scenarios, deceptive pricing strategies, and unfathomable patient benefit matrices. We need to simplify the system so we can focus our limited resources on providing healthcare and improving each of our patients' basic health lifestyles. Let's start with regulating rental networks to remove the smoke and mirrors. Let's provide enhanced patient insurance cards to better identify the payer. Let's improve access to online eligibility information so clinics can verify coverage before the appointment. Let's improve transparency and simplify the business side of healthcare. The practice of medicine is complex enough in itself. And I have four different examples, if that would help, of some of the confusion that we deal with on a daily basis, if you want.
We're running close. I think we understand the issue.
Great.
And we're running short on time. So if we have time later, I would appreciate it, or submit that testimony for the record, and that will, because this bill is definitely coming back. All right. So questions? All right. Thank you very much. And Terry Fitzpatrick and Teresa Miller, come forward.
That's Terry.
Oh, that, you're Terry.
I'm Terry.
Okay. I thought you were someone
else.
No. Thanks, Terry.
Yeah. What I would like to do is you have the...
introduce yourself for the
Terry
record.
Terry Fitzpatrick. I'm the administrator of the Oregon Urology Institute in Springfield. We also have sites in Florence, Roseburg, and Cottage Grove. I'm also the past president of the Oregon Medical Group Management Association, which in the state of Oregon, 300 clinic managers are members, and it's an affiliate of the National Medical Group Management Association. My goal is to kind of give you a little meat on the PowerPoint that you have that just shows how disjointed the system is, and just a couple of the examples we have. We negotiate a contract. We know the terms. Everybody's comfortable. Patient comes in. We know how to take care of the patient. We know how to send ancillary services. We know what the patient's going to be responsible. It's very simple. A classic situation, patient would come in, have seen a primary care physician, have seen a urologist in my case. Urologist says, gee, I think you may have prostate cancer. Let's set you up for a biopsy. Patient comes in for the biopsy and says, oh, by the way, my insurance has changed, and now I have X. So you have a patient with a possible diagnosis of cancer in your waiting room. You have this insurance card, and you have no clue where it came from. You don't know where the contract is. You have no idea what the rates are. You have no idea what the terms are, but you have to take care of the patient because the patient has cancer, or potentially. You take the next step. you do the biopsy, you send the biopsy out, treat the patient, come down the road and you find out that one entity says, whoops, you didn't send the biopsy to our contracted lab, so we're not going to pay you for it. But did you know that up front?
All the time.
Absolutely not.
All the time. This happens all the time, trust me.
A second scenario, which is also very simple. In our office, a patient will come in pain. Physician will say, gee, I think you got a kidney stone. We will call for benefits. We will get some information. In our office, we have imaging. We also have a lithotripsy. So we'll do a CT scan. Yep, you got a kidney stone. We'll set you up and get that taken care of today, which is very unusual, but very good for the patient. Do the kidney stone, process all the paperwork, and then find out, oh, denied, you need to do the procedure here or at a different place. Yet, when we called for authorization, we were given authorization. So just an idea of, on a day-to-day basis in the trenches, things we deal with this situation. Thank you.
Madam Chairwoman, you might want to add, too, sometimes the patient is stuck with the bill.
Mm-hmm. The patient's going to eat it.
This is for patient protection as well. This isn't about physicians. This is about protecting our patients. Mm-hmm. They get caught in these traps, and it can be very expensive. Mm-hmm. You do an MRI in the wrong place, and they've got a bill for $2,000.
Mm-hmm.
It happens all the time.
Yes, Senator Morris.
Just to acknowledge my good friend Terry, thank you for coming.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I worked with Terry when he was in Albany.
Great. Thank you very much. Now let's hear from Teresa Miller, and then we'll get to the opponents.
No. I was on the board.
Okay. This really is a problem.
You directed our physician.
Okay.
This really is a problem.
It's insane.
Was there any other who was for the bill that didn't get to testify? I think I called everyone. Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Teresa Miller. I'm the acting administrator at the Insurance Division at the Department of Consumer and Business Services.
Explain this one to me, Chair.
And I'm here today to testify on Senate Bill 509, which, if I understand the language correctly, requires the Department of Consumer and Business Services to regulate the contracts between physicians and provider networks. Provider networks do play an important role in negotiating discounts for health care, but as you've heard from the proponents of the bill, I know there are some concerns about practices in the industry. So I'm not here to take a position on the bill, but just to discuss a few issues that are raised by the legislation. Senate Bill 509 requires networks to register with the department and also requires the department to develop and implement a regulatory system for ensuring that contracts between physicians and provider networks meet certain requirements. I think Senate Bill 509 it poses a very interesting question for the committee, and that is it necessary to have a government regulatory agency enforce laws governing the contracts between private businesses, or whether or not that's something left to the parties, or better left to the parties and the legal system? Even when the law imposes restrictions on contract terms, usually businesses resort to the courts to enforce those terms and to resolve disputes. And in fact, Senate Bill 509 does specify a private cause of action and includes an attorney provision, which would seem to negate the need for the department to play a role. While the bill doesn't provide clear guidance to the department as to how the legislation should be implemented, it is clear that we would need additional staff to take on this new role. But the bill does not provide the department the ability to assess registration fees to pay for those additional staff. If the committee decides to move forward with this bill, there are a number of technical issues that we would just strongly recommend the committee address, and we would be more than happy to assist the committee in doing so. Just an example of one of those issues is whether or not the provisions of the bill apply to provider network contracts under the workers' compensation system. If you look at the language of the bill, at least it's unclear to us whether or not the bill was intended to apply to workers' compensation. And again, there are a number of other technical issues that we would be more than happy to assist the committee with addressing at the appropriate time. And with that, I appreciate the opportunity to testify. Excellent. All right. Lots of issues before us. Mm-hmm. All right. John Powell. Thank you, Teresa. John Powell, Dave Fiscom.
Interesting. Yeah, we open up a whole bunch of stuff.
I have a Providence card for my life.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Madam Chair and members, we don't think that this bill was aimed at practices of Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. However, our attorneys tell us that some of the provisions, the way they are worded, would in fact impact the way we interact with the National Association's program that allows our insureds the benefit of the contracts that have been developed with physicians and hospitals in other jurisdictions when they travel. So I'm going to let Kim Wirtz present that testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kim Wirtz. I'm with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, and we appreciate the opportunity to present some comments here. As John pointed out, our concerns have to do not with the rationale behind the bill, but with regards to the impact it would have on a process that we participate in as a member of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association. We refer to it as the Blue Card Program. Blue Card allows a member within the Blue Cross Blue Shield system who's traveling to incur expenses within the local area, and it causes the local plan to process those claims and use the contracted rates so that it's a familiar process for the providers, and we basically remove that burden of a cross-state line kind of claim filing for the providers and for the patient. We would have to vigorously oppose any bill that would disrupt that, and from the read that we've given this bill, it does appear that there are some implications in this language that would disrupt Blue Card. As a part of the testimony, giving you an example of the value of Blue Card, we pulled records last night with regards to the PEB program and recognized that we, in 2008, saw savings of nearly $16 million for PEB members alone by use of the Blue Card program. So this would be a key issue for us going forward. We believe the bill as written would jeopardize Blue Card. It would add a level of regulatory requirements and would increase administrative costs, and we urge a careful consideration to ensure the process that our members rely on is not disrupted and that the changes within the healthcare system adhere to the reform principles that we're all talking about so frequently.
Would you be willing to work with the proponents of the bill?
Absolutely.
On language?
Yes.
All right. Mr. Fiscom.
Madam Chair, committee members, good morning. Still morning, isn't it? For the record, Dave Fiscom here representing two health insurance clients from my firm, Providence Health Plan and United Healthcare. Both are actively involved in insurance policy issues this session, including appearing before you and your counterparts on the House side on a number of issues. And frankly, the clients I represent and my firm represents are still analyzing the language of Senate Bill 509, it having just appeared a few days ago, and pleased to be here at this hearing to talk just briefly about it. Both of these organizations, as health insurers in this state, remain committed to moving forward on health care reform policy matters this session. In that spirit, feel that, to be frank with you, it's a bit unfortunate that we have to deal with this issue, though at your discretion we're pleased to do so if we have to. I tend to find these issues in the realm of contract law between theoretically willing parties who sign a contract, and if one side doesn't live up to that, or the other side, if either side lives up to the contract, so be it. There are remedies for that. There are solutions for that. And to the extent that networks are rented, if you will, or leased, or whatever the word is, provider networks are rented, in my experience, and there could be exceptions to this, and there could be failures, I understand, but in my experience, in my contacts with my clients, those such agreements are always done pursuant to a specific provision in the contract. And if the contract is not lived up to, if there are violations of a contract, there are other remedies than seeking, in my judgment, legislative intervention. Frankly, I would have hoped that the issues that the OMA has, I respect the organization, could have been dealt with straight out with insurers. And if we could, my experience is that if we talk together about such issues and the experts from our side and their side are in the same room, we could resolve a lot of issues in that setting as opposed to bringing them to you. Madam Chair, in that spirit, we're very willing to keep working on this issue. I'm expecting specific language concerns to be expressed by both of my clients. I will tell you that I had a memo this morning at 7:30, and I'm not sharing it with you because I don't understand it yet in this difficult issue of contract law between, as I, again, emphasize to you, willing parties. there's a contract with a provider group, and that provider group has agreed to language that allows for that group to be rented, then that provision of the contract ought to be adhered to, ought to be honored. And if something occurs in violation of such provisions or without, as the word has been used this morning several times, transparency, that ought to be rectified. I'll stop with that. We'd be willing to work on this if we need to, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And the last two on this bill, Lise Brown and Lisa Tressel.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Montes Anderson, members of the committee. Elise Brown, and I'm here today representing America's Health Insurance Plans. And in the interest of time, I'm not going to repeat the good comments that my colleagues have just made, but I would add pick up on the comment that was made by the representative from the America Medical Association, is that yes, we have been working on this issue, in fact, over the last couple of years, and there has been major disagreement on AMA's proposal. I would ask that this committee and that we are happy to work with the rest of the stakeholders to come up with some alternatives. AHIP has presented a model plan, and I'd love the time to work with the stakeholders on that issue.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Tressel with Health Plans of Oregon, and I just wanted to add our concerns with the bill. We're still evaluating it, but it appears that the bill addresses a broader target than what the OMA had indicated they were interested in addressing. And so for after we have time to evaluate, we should be able to come back with more specific concerns. But again, all of these are voluntary contracts. I think the insurance administrator pointed out a significant policy decision if you want to start addressing contractual relationships by statute. Thank you.
Thank you. And Ms. Schumacher, Regents was the only one that gave written testimony, I believe. Is that correct? And if you're certainly privy to that. That's in the back room, but Courtney has it. So I think Courtney Dresser is here. I think that who represents the American Medical Association, and she has heard the concerns, and I will charge you with convening a work group with the opponents and keep Mr. Shook in the loop. And if you need Doc Bates for as a mediator, he's excellent.
Madam Chair, I will tell you this. This has been a problem for years. It's getting worse. And having legislation in front of us sort of forces the issue, and I think it's the right thing to do. And you know, this is so complex that we spend about 30% of our health care dollars trying to figure this stuff out. And that's my office and everybody else's office. And I'll frankly tell you, I don't understand it all myself, not even half of it. It gets so complex with this contracting, and unnecessarily so. It's like you're building a nuclear weapon before you're through and you don't know if it's going to go off or not. So I would like them to sit down and see if they can come up with common language to work for everybody, and I will help them facilitate it if necessary.
If necessary. Okay. Yeah. And Courtney will let you
and
know. Yes,
Senator Cruz.
Senator
Cruz, join me again.
I'm sorry. Madam Chair, I just want to, Senator Bates, I either need to move south or you need to move north, one of the two, because you know, I signed on to this bill and others specifically because I love being in the middle of controversy, I guess. But you know, it's kind of a growing frustration, and it's not just in this arena; it's in the whole financial arena, in the whole banking arena, and how everything has gotten so complicated and so convoluted and so otherworldly in the way we conduct business in this country, that it's absurd. Things should be understandable, and this is a small piece, obviously, but when you look at Wall Street, when you look at the banking industry and all of the hijinks and shenanigans that have gone on, and it's so complicated, nobody can decide who's up, who's down, who's responsible, being just a simple country boy, I think things should be written the way I can understand them. So I'd be more than happy to work on this.
Okay. You've got the message. All right. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 509, and I'd like to open a public hearing on SJM 5.
SJM 5, Madam Chair, urges Congress to enact legislation creating the Office of National Nurse.
National Nurse? Goodness gracious.
Are you applying for the job?
You're going to be a lobbyist. Let's wait a year.
We didn't vote on it.
Why didn't they vote for
it?
Oh, really?
So we're going to vote on it now. We're up to vote on 9.
Okay.
You won. No, this is the first time.
Well, I'm glad you asked where that lady was from. I was ready. She wasn't from Oregon.
Who's going to go first?
Hey,
March. Okay.
Hi. Chair Amos Anderson, members of the Senate Health Care and Veterans Affairs Committee. My name is Mark Schwepke. I'll keep my comments very brief. I am president of the American Federation of Teachers of Oregon. Our members work from pre-K to post-secondary institutions in both public and private sector. Our members interact with every facet of the education enterprise in Oregon. In addition, AFT Oregon members in Oregon include over 2,500 nurses and other healthcare professionals with Kaiser Permanente and Providence, Milwaukee. Along with our new partners with the Oregon School Employees Association, AFT members in Oregon number over 33,000 and live and work in every legislative district in the state. AFT Oregon unanimously passed a resolution at their 2006 state convention urging support of the Office of National Nurse. Later that same year, the National American Federation of Nurses of Teachers, representing over 1.4 million members in the United States, including 40,000 nurses from the AFT Health Division, unanimously passed a resolution supporting the Office of National Nurse. As a visible professional spokesperson, the National Nurse will be a valuable beacon for recruitment and will promote volunteerism of nurses and other healthcare professionals within existing frameworks, such as the local Medical Reserve Corps. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. Thanks for waiting.
Good morning, Madam Chairwoman, and also committee members. My name is Terry Mills. I'm a nurse educator, and I've been teaching in Oregon now for 33 years. I'm also have worked as a nurse practitioner in two busy public health clinics. I'm a member of the Oregon Nurses Association, the American Federation of Teachers, and currently I serve as the president of the National Nursing Network Organization, running the campaign to create this Office of the National Nurse. Today, I am here to ask for your support in requesting Congress enact legislation to create an Office of the National Nurse. Our health care system is failing the American people. 18 other countries are doing better in reducing preventable deaths than the United States, and the U.S. ranks 29th among all industrialized countries in infant mortality. Every year, $1.3 trillion is spent on managing the impact of the seven most common chronic conditions. Most are preventable. I could say so much more about our country's broken healthcare system, but now please allow me to briefly share some information about the proposal to address these issues through an Office of the National The intent of creating this office is to have nurses under the leadership of a national nurse within the U.S. Public Health Service deliver messages of health promotion and illness prevention to every American. Tenets of the proposal are the office led by the national nurse. And to avoid having to ask Congress for new appropriations for a new entity and also to reduce duplication of services, we are asking that the current chief nurse officer's position in the U.S. Public Health Service head the Office of the National Nurse, as this position does currently exist and it is funded. This position, however, needs to be modernized and the job responsibilities shifted to primarily focus on serving as the driving force to deliver messages of prevention to all Americans. The National Nurse would also serve to inspire and engage nurses to become community service volunteers. Nurses would be encouraged to participate in existing organizations such as the Medical Reserve Corps and would add to the focus on delivering health promotion information in their communities. In a Robert Wood Johnson Foundation September 2007 newsletter, Dr. Susan Hasmiller, the senior program officer, states, "Nurses have a pivotal role in promoting preventive care since they spend more time with their patients than any other healthcare professional. By educating and counseling patients about the importance of simple preventive measures, nurses can have a significant impact on improving health and extending lives. The healthcare system needs to empower and encourage nurses for them to be effective in this role. America's healthcare system is in trouble. Nurses are galvanized by this proposal, and they want to make a difference. We are the largest sector of healthcare. We have unique and special skills and insights to offer the public. We understand that preventive medicine is much better than reactive medicine, that quality of life matters. An Office of the National Nurse would possibly be the most significant way to utilize nursing's collective vast wealth of knowledge to improve our nation's health. And we hope that you, as concerned healthcare consumers and esteemed elected officials, will join us so that the Office of the National Nurse will become a reality in our lifetime. Because of federal timelines and with a trip planned by many to Washington, D.C. next month, we would like to request a work session and for this committee to consider moving this forward today. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chairwoman and committee members. I am Elisa Schneider, and I work as an educator at Portland Community College. I have been a pediatric nurse for 20 years. I am an AFT member and founding member of the National Nursing Network Organization. The Office of the National Nurse stands as a focal point of preventive practice in the future of healthcare reform. Just as nurses work alongside physicians and other healthcare providers, the Office of the National Nurse would assist other federal agencies to meet their stated goals of prevention and wellness education. For instance, currently the CDC generates research and information about the country's health needs. Then the Office of the Surgeon General synthesizes and prioritizes that information. What is missing is a delivery system across the population. We propose that the Office of the National Nurse be the vehicle for the delivery of prevention and wellness education so that our nation can improve the epidemics of preventable diseases that are crippling our economy and our people. Nurses use education as a cornerstone of care, no matter what setting they practice in. We are the health profession's frontline educators, and as we are 2.9 million strong and growing, we would be a vast and powerful tool for improving health literacy and reaching across a diverse and broad population. While a few might argue that the current chief nurse officer of the U.S. Public Health Service is our national nurse, we have found over the past 4 years that nurses, healthcare providers, and the public don't know this role exists or the functions that it serves. We are asking that this legislature urge Congress to elevate the rank of this position, make it a full-time position with the duties of collaboration and coordination of prevention and wellness education, with the recognizable title of National Nurse. This is an Oregon-born initiative, and it would be an honor to have this legislative body support it. Nurses hold too few positions of power and influence at the national level, and this is a crucial time for nursing's unique input to be included in healthcare policy and reform. The Office of the National Nurse would certainly not be a cure-all for all of the problems in healthcare and in nursing, but it is a necessary part of affecting change in our nation's health and including nurses in that change. Thank you very much.
Questions? All right.
thank you so much, because I know how hard you've been working on this.
We do have two more supporters to testify.
Shelley Johnson and Cheryl.
Thank you.
Oaks Caddy?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Shelley Johnson, and I am a nurse in maternal and newborn health and a member of the Oregon Nurses Association.
Today, and I went to your pinning, nursing pinning, I forget when, last year. So it's been a while.
Yes. Thank you for your time today. Today I'm here to ask for your support in requesting that the Congress of the United States enact legislation to create an Office of the National Nurse. Gaining acceptance into nursing school took me 5 solid years of studying and applying. Today there are hundreds of pre-nursing students experiencing the same situation. These students could really benefit from being involved volunteering in healthy living fairs and other disease prevention events in their communities. This initiative would provide coordinated systems among nurses that would utilize highly motivated, unpaid volunteers who are eager to serve their communities. Last year, as a student nurse, I was so inspired by the opportunities of the National Nurse, the Office of the National Nurse, that I urged Senator Lori Montes Anderson on behalf of Portland Community College's class of 2008 with signatures from the entire class to introduce the resolution for the Office of the National Nurse to Congress. Caring for patients with preventable diseases every day, I am positive this initiative will benefit the health of this nation. Thank you for your consideration.
Hi, Madam Chairwoman and committee members. My name is Cheryl Oaks Caddy. I am a registered nurse here in the state of Oregon and also a licensed attorney. I work as a staff nurse at Good Samaritan Regional Medical Center in Corvallis. I teach nursing students at Lynn Benton Community College in Albany, and I represent nurses before the Board of Nursing here in Oregon. So I talk to people all the time about nursing. I have talked to many coworkers, students alike, and to echo what you've already said, most people don't understand about this chief nurse officer position within the U.S. Public Health Service. And it seems so obvious when you start talking about the position of national nurse, why hasn't this been done already? We're talking about a low financial impact for such a potentially large return on for our dollar, which is something that we're not really getting a lot of in healthcare. As I mentioned, I've talked to many people about it. Probably the collective response, I was summed very well by my daughter, who said, it's a part-time position. It must be a real important job. And she, you know, and it's true. This should be a very important job. You know, this would be, as said before, a focus for nursing in the United States. We need the collaborative effort between the Surgeon General's office, the National Nurse, to provide health care, education, teaching, the messages for preventative care in this country to reduce the costs that we encounter on a daily basis. The other thing that this would do, as has been mentioned, is also legitimize the profession of nursing. We all know that we have a nursing shortage going on. It's variable in different places what the exact impact is. So we do need to use this as a recruitment tool, but not only a recruitment tool for new nurses, but the legitimization of the profession would encourage those people who are already in practice to reach a little higher, because the next problem that we have as far as the nursing shortage goes is shortage of nurse educators. So we need to energize the profession, and this giving nursing a national focal point would go a long way towards that. So I'm here today just to also urge you to please send this message to Congress from the state of Oregon to do this. This is an Oregon initiative. Oregon has been very innovative in healthcare. We have, you know, the Oregon Health Plan. We have the Death with Dignity Act, and as you heard this morning, the post forms that are being used outside of the state, which has a big impact. People do look towards Oregon for their ideas. This is a fabulous idea, and it should be coming from Oregon, introduced to Congress, and be acted upon appropriately, which is, of course, to expand that nursing role in the United Health Public Health Service to encompass the national nurse. So I also am a member of the American Association of Nurse Attorneys, and we last year as a group have endorsed this proposal and would encourage you to do so also. So anyhow, thank you for the opportunity.
All right. Is there any discussion? I can't believe all the nurses that contacted me through email, through your Portland Community College nursing program, et cetera. So if there's no discussion, I'd like to close the public hearing on SJM-5 and open a work session on SJM-5.
Madam Chair, I move SJM-5 be adopted and moved to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Jeff Cruz moves SJM-5 to the Senate floor with a due adopt.
Due adopt, excuse me.
Yeah, due adopt. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bates?
Aye.
Senator Morissette?
Aye.
Senator Morris?
Aye.
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Monsanto?
Aye.
Will you carry that?
I will carry that, and it's adopted. Colleagues, let's carry over the PKU bill, SB9.
Bill 9 is in your packet. We have the fiscal, and we have the revenue.
Then what's the problem?
Okay, we'll open a work session on SB 9. That is the PKU bill.
Madam Chair, I move SB 9 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves SB 9 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. And Senator Cruz is going to carry the bill, and we are adjourned.
Great.
Thank you.
Wow.